Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Instagram propose des outils pour la famille qui permettent à vos proches de naviguer de façon raisonnable et en toute sécurité sur l'application. Quand les ados créent leur profil Instagram, les comptes privés par défaut garantissent que ce qu'ils publient n'est visible que par eux et les personnes qui les suivent. Choisir une limite quotidienne de temps aide votre ado à naviguer de façon raisonnable sur Instagram. Et paramétrer les outils de supervision ensemble vous offre une meilleure visibilité des comptes suivis par votre ado. Pour en savoir plus sur ces outils et en découvrir d'autres, rendez-vous sur instagram.com/outils pour la famille.
Le changement peut sembler insurmontable, comme s'il s'agissait d'un projet trop ambitieux ou trop complexe. Mais si ce n'était pas le cas, Expléo combine ses expertises de digitalisation et d'ingénierie. Nos ingénieurs vous aideront à appliquer les dernières innovations digitales à vos processus existants. Et si vous pouviez modifier un élément clé sans bouleverser tout le reste de votre organisation? Expléo, et si c'était maintenant? Pour en savoir plus, rendez-vous sur expléo.com/essi.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 7th of December, these are our main stories. In a highly unusual move, the UN Secretary General invokes an article of the UN Charter to urge the Security Council to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. President Biden asks Republicans to approve funding for Ukraine's war effort, urging compromise.
Republicans think they get everything they want without any bipartisan compromise. That's not the answer.
Also,
when I first came to Indonesia, I had two children. When the locals pushed back the boat, one of my children died.
The misery of Rohingya refugees who fled from Bangladesh to Indonesia. Also, this podcast.
Just recently, we found where they are. There's a small area where we work in, and that's it. We don't have any other records of them anywhere.
The giant pangolins discovered in Kenya and the plans to protect them. Plus, the singer Taylor Swift is named as Time magazine's Person of the Year. In a highly unusual move, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has tried to ensure the deteriorating situation in Gaza is discussed as soon as possible by the Security Council. In a letter to members of the Council, Mr. Guterres warned of a collapse of the humanitarian system in the territory. He again stressed the urgent need for a ceasefire, warning of potentially irreversible implications for Palestinians and for the security in the whole region. At a news briefing in New York, his spokesman, Stefan Dujarric, said the Secretary General had taken the rare step of invoking an article of the UN Charter.
This is the first time that Antonio Guterres has done this since he became Secretary General in 2017. Article 99 states, and I quote, that the Secretary General may bring to the attention of the Security Council any matter in his opinion that may threaten the maintenance of international peace and security. In the letter, which has been shared with you, the Secretary General urges the members of the Security Council to press to avert a humanitarian catastrophe, and he appeals for a humanitarian ceasefire to be declared.
On Wednesday, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his forces were surrounding the house of a top Hamas leader, saying he could flee, but it was only a matter of time until he was found. He also pressed the Red Cross to visit Israeli hostages held in Gaza. Our correspondent Hugo Bachega reports now from Jerusalem.
House-to-house fighting in Gaza. In the north, there's been intense bombardment of the Jabalia refugee camp. To the south, airstrikes have continued to hit Khan Yunis, and Israeli tanks are said to be encircling the house of the top Hamas leader, Yahya Sinwar. At the city's Nasser Hospital, the staff are unable to treat everyone. This is Dr. Mohammed Kandil.
Around 70% of the medical team, they cannot reach the hospital. Now we're working with only four doctors. In the regular days, we have around 35 to 40 doctors.
The Israeli military says its attacks are precise and that it is taking steps to protect the population. But today, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees was unequivocal. It said it had seen no recalibration of the country's tactics, describing a pattern of attacks targeting or impacting civilian infrastructure. Lynn Hastings is the UN's humanitarian coordinator in the Palestinian territories. She's being expelled from Israel.
Gaza is just not safe. There is nowhere to go. They are literally being chased from corner to corner by the Israelis. We're looking at 1.5 million people being displaced. The scale of destruction, I don't know if that will ever be able to be repaired.
The Israeli authorities are under pressure at home too, from the families of the hostages who remain in Gaza. They say they've received solid intelligence that some captives are at risk of dying.
The president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Mediana Spoljaric, who visited Gaza on Monday, has responded to criticism of their role in facilitating the release of Israeli hostages. In a moment, we'll hear more about that. But first, James Menendez started by asking her what she saw on her trip to Gaza.
The humanitarian situation in Gaza is devastating. The situation in the hospital where I was shocking. Surgeons are exhausted. I saw many people with atrocious wounds. I saw children that were visibly malnourished and probably starving. We have very limited mobility, but whenever we can, we deliver fuel, deliver water, deliver medicine. A lot of the surgeries are being conducted without anesthesia, so this is a big priority for us. But we need a predictable flow of medical assistance. We are committed to stay. We are not leaving. We need to de-escalate. We need to see an operating space that allows us to move from A to B.
Can I ask you about the hostages? The Israeli foreign minister said that he expected the Red Cross to put the issue at the top of its priority list. Is it at the top of that priority list?
It is at the very top of our priority list, including my own. Under current circumstances, this is not only difficult, but also very dangerous for the hostages themselves. Access to hostages requires an agreement between the parties on how we would implement that when it happens. And that agreement is lacking at the moment. So we are talking to both sides to make sure that they allow us to go without endangering the hostages themselves. Everybody has to agree on how this access is going to be implemented.
One can't imagine that Israel would hold up Red Cross access to the hostages. So it's really up to Hamas to give you that access, isn't it?
We are demanding that Hamas gives us access. This requires two sides. We are not commenting because we are not part of these negotiations. Right. And we cannot be as a neutral actor, but we want to implement it.
There has been this phrase that's gained some traction on social media in Israel, describing the ICRC as a mere Uber service for the hostages. In other words, those who have been released, just putting them in vehicles and getting them out of Gaza. What's your response to that?
This is profoundly unjust, unfair, and it's wrong. These operations are extremely complex. They require a very close cooperation, especially also with the Israeli side, and they know what it takes to implement these releases. We are working around the clock with the authorities on the Israeli side to make them possible whenever there is an agreement to release hostages.
The president of the ICRC, Mirjana Spoljaric, speaking there to James Menendez. President Biden has urged Republican congressmen and women to approve a multi-billion dollar assistance package for Ukraine. In return for Republican support, Mr. Biden said he could compromise over their demands for tougher measures against migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border.
This has to be a negotiation. Republicans think they get everything they want without any bipartisan compromise. That's not the answer. And now they're willing to literally kneecap Ukraine on the battlefield and damage our national security in the process.
The White House has warned that U.S. funds for Ukraine could soon run out. The U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said it was vital to reach a deal with those Republicans who are opposed to further military aid for Ukraine.
We have nearly exhausted the available security assistance that is available to Ukraine. It is urgent that Congress act, especially as we enter this difficult winter when we know we will see increased Russian attacks.
With more details, here's Nomia Iqbal in Washington.
President Biden's warning to Congress is stark. He said if President Putin wins, he won't stop there and that American troops could be dragged into a future war. But appetite to support Kyiv is fading, especially amongst many Republicans. Since the war began, Congress has directed more than $110 billion to Ukraine in military, humanitarian and financial assistance. Republicans say there needs to be a better strategy to justify spending American taxpayers' money. They're due to vote on sending $61 billion to Ukraine, but it's part of a larger national security package, and Republicans want to add border security policy changes to it, which has stalled the funding.
Nomi Iqbal. More than 1,000 Rohingya Muslims have sought refuge in the Indonesian province of Aceh after perilous days spent in rickety boats at sea. They'd become refugees for a second time after initially fleeing violence in Myanmar to neighbouring Bangladesh. But they now say conditions in the refugee camps at Cox's Bazar have become increasingly unbearable. As BBC Indonesia's Hana Samosir reports from Aceh, tensions with local people have been rising. A warning that parts of her report are distressing.
A group of angry residents blocks a boat carrying more than 200 Rohingya refugees. "You cannot dock here," they tell them, and stop the passengers from reaching the shore. Yasmin Fatoum and her two young children were among those on board. She, like her fellow passengers, set sail from the refugee camps in Bangladesh Cox Bazar in search of better lives in Indonesia. The 25-year-old spent days at sea in dire conditions, with threat of disease and a lack of food.
"When I first came to Indonesia, I had two children. When the locals pushed back the boat, one of my children died on the boat. I didn't have any water, so I gave salty water to my baby. Her condition worsened, and she died. We couldn't do anything, so we threw her into the sea."
After being pushed away twice and waiting for several days in the water, the flimsy vessel was finally allowed to dock. Yasmin and her son, along with other refugees, were brought to an old government building.
"Here, tens of people are squeezed into one room. Some of them are sick, but they have no choice."
Over 1,000 Rohingya refugees have arrived in Aceh in the last month alone, making their journey in 6 overladen boats. More than half of them are children. On the same boat as Yasmin is Rohima Khatum. Despite having a disability, she was determined to flee from Cox Bazar with her sons.
"We had a lot of terrorists in the camp. They threatened to kill our children, rape our mothers and daughters, and rob us. They took my child and asked for money, or they threatened to kill him. They already killed one of my children and dumped his body in the ditch."
The Indonesian government, through a presidential decree, said it would collaborate with institutions such as the United Nations and other international organizations to handle arrivals. But the country's foreign ministry also said that Indonesian goodwill in providing shelters had been exploited by human trafficking networks. In the overcrowded shelter, Yasmin is still grieving for the loss of her infant daughter.
"When I came here, I hoped that the residents would accept us. I want to pray to God to get a bigger place because this place is not enough for everyone."
Yasmin, ending that report from BBC Indonesia's Hana Samosir in Aceh. African pangolins are one of the world's most trafficked mammals. Their scales are in high demand in traditional Chinese medicine. They were thought to be extinct in Kenya, but a team of conservationists discovered giant ones. Now the conservationists are working with the local community to increase pangolin numbers and to help protect them. Victoria Awanhunda spoke to Beryl McCorry, who's the program manager for the Pangolin Project, and she asked when pangolins were last seen in Kenya.
"Very many years ago, maybe 70s.
Wow.
There was just one record around the Lake Victoria basins, and that's it.
So back in the 70s will be the last record that they were seeing, the giant ground pangolins. So why did their numbers shrink?"
"Just recently we found where they are. There's a small area where we work in, and that's it. We don't have any other records of them anywhere. So their shrinking numbers may be attributed to the many threats that they face, which is mostly electric fences that are killing lots and lots of them, and then habitat loss, and then poaching." We just started working on this population a year and a few months plus. So we are not yet talking about bringing the population to where we would like it to be. We're just beginning to, you know, eliminate rats and make sure the population isn't doing worse, like reduce the numbers that are dying on electric fences and make sure their habitat is safe. Before now, we can start saying we've increased the numbers from this number to now this one.
So how many do you have now?
Oh, we are looking at between 30 and 80 giant ground pangolins in the whole of Kenya.
How much would you like to see them grow to?
Oh, we are hoping for 200 and above in that small area, and hoping that there is also another population in other small pockets of forest. It's just that they have not been confirmed, but we are hoping they should be there.
And how are you bringing in the local communities in your quest to try and bring these numbers up?
So the problem in this area is that the area was subdivided, and then it has experienced 80% of forest loss. And that means everyone is now demarcating their land. So we are working with these landowners to remove electricity on the lower strands of their fences so that pangolins can pass through safe, because that's one of their major threats. We lose two every month from electric fences. And then secondly, we are working with them to secure habitats so they can lease their land for conservation away from agriculture and farms, and now lease their land for conservation so that we'll have a secure habitat, not just for pangolins, for every other biodiversity. One win that we have in this area is that the landowners are already willing to be part of conservation.
Beryl Macquarie speaking there to Victoria Awanhunda. Time magazine has named the American singer Taylor Swift as its Person of the Year for 2023. Mark Savage is our culture correspondent, and I asked him why now. Nice to meet
you, where you been? Taylor Swift has been famous for a very long time, but something shifted in 2023, partly because of this massive tour that she's done in both North and South America, her Eras tour, where she has deliberately gone back and revisited every single album that she's released up until now. It's a career-spanning tour. It comes 6 years after she was last able to tour, and in that time she put out multiple albums, some of which are considered her most artistically valid records of all. So there was this huge pent-up appetite to see her. When the tickets went on sale, the Ticketmaster website fell apart, and the owners of that business were called into the US Senate to explain what had gone wrong. When the tour went to cities around the US, people who couldn't get tickets congregated in the car parks, thousands of them, to listen to the songs. And there is just this cultural weight that she has carried through the pandemic into the real world of concerts in 2023.
She is, I think, the only one to feature solo, a musician, on the front cover of Time as Person of the Year. So what makes her so special?
It's one of those things in pop music. Everybody has what's called an imperial phase. Madonna had one in the 80s. Lady Gaga had one about 15 years ago. And Taylor Swift is just at that crest of the wave right now. She has been big before on albums like Fearless and 1989, where she graduated to becoming a stadium pop star, where people were paying attention to what she said. But then she had a bit of a fall. There was this period maybe 7 years ago where there were accusations that her brand of feminism was not the right sort of feminism, whatever that means. She was also under attack from other pop stars. Very famously, Kanye West used Taylor Swift in ways that are borderline despicable, putting naked images of her in his music videos, taunting her at award shows. And then she lost all the rights to her master tape. But she picked herself up during the pandemic. She recorded these two albums of beautiful folklore inspired indie music called Folklore and Evermore that won her a third Grammy for Album of the Year. American Dynasty. Who knows if she never showed up, what could have been? There goes the maddest woman. And then she carried that momentum through out of the pandemic, making more pop music, making more albums, making statements that endeared her to her fans, and building up a very intimate relationship with her fans, which is something she has been a master of.
Mm-hmm. Mark Savage on Taylor Swift, who is Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
China says it's about mutually beneficial relations, but critics say it's a form of influence and it traps countries in debt and then it tries to extract political concessions, military concessions.
Is this why Italy has pulled out of China's Belt and Road Initiative? Stay tuned to find out. Let's return now to our top story. Israel's foreign minister says the UN Secretary General's tenure is a danger to world peace. Eli Cohen was reacting to the decision by Antonio Guterres to invoke Article 99 of the UN Charter. Earlier, the Israeli ambassador to the UN called it a new moral low. A correspondent in New York, Neda Tofik, told me more about the significance of the Secretary General's action.
By their own admission, it's quite a dramatic move, and certainly one that's meant to send a clear message to the Security Council that the Secretary General is frustrated with them and is trying to remind them of their responsibilities. This is the first time that Antonio Guterres has ever invoked Article 99, which essentially gives him the power to bring to the attention of the Security Council matters that he thinks are of a grave threat to the maintenance of international peace and security. I mean, it's been several decades since it's been invoked. It's only been invoked a handful of times by other secretary generals in the past. And now you have this, perhaps the most powerful distress signal coming from the secretary general.
Has there been any reaction so far?
There has been, yes. Arab group ambassadors at the United Nations got together. They have circulated a very short resolution, which very simply reiterates the Secretary General's invoking of Article 99 and calls for a ceasefire. They have circulated that. It's unclear, though, when there will be a vote. We know that several Arab foreign ministers are meeting with the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, on Friday. And remember, the United States, as Israel's ally, has opposed another resolution, has opposed calls for a ceasefire. So we'll see what those discussions yield. We've also had reaction from the Israeli mission, which has reacted quite angrily to the Secretary General's invoking of Article 99. They say that he reached a new moral low with this and that he is again showing his moral distortion and his bias against Israel.
Neda Tofik. Meanwhile, Israeli troops are involved in intense battles with Hamas in the heart of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Evan Davis spoke to two people in Khan Yunis, Mohammed Galiani, an atmospheric scientist from England who was on holiday in Gaza when the conflict started and is staying put, and first to Akram, a translator based in the city.
People were asked to move from their places. So a very large influx of people who don't know where to go, don't know what to take, what to leave, what to prioritize, how to walk down the streets with the lack of transportation. And I was just now in Khan Yunis refugee camp visiting my mother, and a drone that was firing indiscriminate fire in the streets of the refugee camp. Khan Yunis refugee camp has been the most overcrowded area in whole Khan Yunis city. And this firing was going on just 20 minutes ago. The bombardments are part of the daily routine, and the displacement is already becoming part of the daily routine of the people in Gaza.
So I just want to be clear, Akram. We know drones have been flying overhead in surveillance. You say the drone was firing on the refugee camp?
Yes, the drone was firing in more than four different locations, over the refugee camp, in the streets of the refugee camp, and to the houses of the refugee camp.
If I can just add some extra context, we've heard many reports of low-level drones that fire machine gun fire, positioning themselves like at building height and firing on people that move, basically. So that's the context, because I think a lot of the drones that we've heard about are, you know, rocket drones, but no, this is like a machine gun in the air.
Akram, it's been very striking talking to people in Gaza that there is a defiance of not wanting to get out of Gaza and leave that piece of land with the sense that you'd never get back in if you left. I wonder whether you find people are growing tired and thinking, I do just want to get out now. Is that happening?
When you have 1.8 million people moving all together, where would they be able to go? They asked the people to move from the north to the south. And then now you're asking people to move from the south to the very south. And they understand that the last step would be asking them to move from Rafah, which is in the very south, to Sinai. So they say, we stay on our land and we consider that as part of the fight for the sake of staying on this land.
That hasn't changed, or you think people are beginning to think, I can't put up with this?
No. According to what I see, there are tens of thousands of people who are not willing to leave their homes, their villages, or their town, not even to leave their properties. And there are many other people who are understandably seeking safety. But the issue that makes things worse for those who are seeking safety is that they might be also moving to the very south in Rafah, and they would be killed, or they would be injured, or the areas that they are staying in, they would be bombarded.
Akram and Mohammed speaking to Evan Davis. When Italy joined China's Belt and Road Initiative, it was criticised by the US and others. Italy was the only major Western nation to join the infrastructure plan, but it is now pulling out. The Belt and Road proposal was launched by China's President Xi Jinping back in 2013, and it's believed aims to invest $1 trillion across Asia and Europe. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, told me more about why Italy signed up in the first place.
It joined under the former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte in 2019. It was hoping for a big boost to trade. At the time, the Italian economy was quite stagnant. There was talk about historical links, Marco Polo and the maritime silk route of the medieval times. And Italy was the only G7 nation to sign up. There are other European nations that are linked into Belt and Road, but Italy was a coup for China and for what is essentially its flagship foreign policy. Belt and Road has been going for 10 years. There's about 150 countries involved, Europe, Asia, as you mentioned, but also Africa and Latin America. So it really is a global project. And in essence, it's about building land and sea trade routes. So a lot of it is to do with construction, investment and development of things like roads, railways, tunnels, airports, bridges, that sort of thing. But there's also cultural elements, scientific elements. So it's really bringing in a wider development. China says it's about mutually beneficial relations, but critics say it's a form of influence buying. And they say that what China does is it traps countries in debt, and then it tries to extract concessions, political concessions, military concessions, perhaps control over things like strategic ports, that sort of thing.
And is that why it was so divisive when Italy joined?
Yes. I mean, that was something that the US was warning about in particular. They were warning about things like, for example, trade partnerships with Italian companies that had sensitive technological data and that leaking back to China, that sort of thing. So the Italian government under Giorgia Meloni said this whole thing was a mistake, and it's seen as trying to back out of it.
So where does this leave the Belt and Road Initiative?
Well, Italy has played this rather carefully. They haven't done a massive political statement. I presume that's based on allowing China to save face. But it says that China remains a very important trading partner for Italy. It's its 10th biggest export partnership. And so it still wants to keep excellent relations with China, it says.
Danny Eberhard. Federal and local authorities in India are investigating a prestigious private hospital in Delhi that's accused of involvement in the sale of organs. The allegations were raised by a British newspaper, which said that a scam had targeted impoverished villagers from Myanmar. Charles Havland reports.
India's Apollo Hospitals is one of the world's biggest private hospital groups, with facilities across Asia. The London Daily Telegraph has now accused it of being embroiled in the illicit sale of kidneys. Using undercover reporters, it said it had learned that poor Burmese people were flown to India after being persuaded to sell their organs to rich compatriots. The operations were allegedly carried out at the Apollo Hospital in the Delhi suburb of Sarita Vihar. Apollo Hospitals denies any willful complicity in what it calls shocking allegations. It says it'll also hold an investigation. Much of the alleged racket was said to have been arranged through Apollo's Myanmar office, which is said to have worked with agents to forge family trees and marriage certificates to imply that the kidney donor and recipient were related. In fact, said the Telegraph, in 80% of the cases, they were unrelated. Neither Myanmar nor India allows strangers to donate organs, and the sale of organs is outlawed in most of the world.
Charles Havland. Born in Atlanta, Georgia, to Ethiopian parents, Armen Bahana is a singer-songwriter as well as a filmmaker and screenwriter. When he released his debut album back in 2019, the track Janet went viral, and Grey Love featured on Atlanta, a hit TV series about his hometown's hip-hop scene. That same year, Bahana went to Ethiopia for the first time. That trip inspired his highly anticipated new album, The Nomad's Dream. He's been speaking to the BBC.
End of 2019, that's when I went to Ethiopia for the first time. And I took my mom back, and she hadn't been back to the country in over 40 years. So that experience was really powerful, kind of shook me. A couple of months after that, the pandemic hit. So, of course, we have all this time to ourselves to be thinking and reflecting. And then I had a family member pass away. It felt like this domino effect where everything was like leading to me doing a deep dive in terms of like my own self, my culture, where I'm from, but also my family, just accepting all that life has to give, what my individual life has given me. That was the spark for the album. The album is called Amen, The Nomad's Dream. The nomad is this character who's trying to bring this sense of home with him wherever he goes. This character that has a foot in two different worlds. How we open up the album is a song called Amen. It was like revisiting my childhood through a dream. So you hear my mom knocking on the bedroom door while I'm playing music really loud. She's telling me to turn it off. And then you hear me crank up the music a little more and try to drown her out. And that sort of fades into the album. That for me was important because that's me. That's my life growing up. I live in a very Habesha household, but also an American household. And I wanted to listen to American music and the music I wanted to listen to, be my own person. And it's like both sides of that coin. That is who I am, you know? We closed the album with a song called Going Home. If you listen to the song and you listen to older Ethiopian classics from like the 70s, Ethiopian jazz songs, you can hear that kind of sound in my album, yeah. There's a through line there with some of the melodies. But also you hear auto-tune and you hear things that feel like, oh, this is, you know, this is now, this is present, this is my world. The lyrics of that song are, I know right now we're drenched in sorrow, but the sun's still gonna come up tomorrow. Say you love me, then go tell your mama, then give thanks to the one that's above. And then at the very end of that song, you hear a voice, my grandmother's voice, who wishes me well on my journey.
And that was Bahana's grandmother wishing him all the best as he explores his personal journey. And there's plenty more from Bahana. Just search online for BBC This Is Africa and you can hear a longer interview with him. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Philip Bull. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Le changement peut sembler insurmontable, comme s'il s'agissait d'un projet trop ambitieux ou trop complexe. Mais si ce n'était pas le cas, Expléo combine ses expertises de digitalisation et d'ingénierie. Nos ingénieurs vous aideront à appliquer les dernières innovations digitales à vos processus existants. Et si vous pouviez modifier un élément clé sans bouleverser tout le reste de votre organisation? Expléo, et si c'était maintenant? Pour en savoir plus, rendez-vous sur expluo.com/essai.